stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Michael Brown reporting. The United States is commemorating the 15th anniversary of the September 11th terrorist attack Sunday, when al-Qaeda terrorists hijacked planes and flew them into the World Trade Center in New York and the Pentagon near Washington. Another plane crashed in rural Pennsylvania. President Barack Obama observed a moment of silence at the White House earlier today. At the time, the first of the four hijacked planes slammed into the World Trade Center before speaking at a ceremony at the Pentagon honoring those killed.
Groups like al-Qaeda, like ISIL, know that they will never be able to defeat a nation as great and as strong as America. So instead, they try to terrorize in the hopes that they can stoke enough fear that we turn on each other, and that we change who we are or how we live. And that's why it is so important today that we reaffirm our character as a nation.
Victims killed in the attack on the World Trade Center were remembered in New York, where presidential candidates Republican Donald Trump and Democrat Hillary Clinton halted their campaigns for the day to pay their respects at Ground Zero. Clinton appeared for a time before being driven away amid reports she was feeling overheated. A time later, she left her daughter's apartment in New York, waving and smiling, but made no comments to reporters. The Trump campaign has attempted to raise questions about Clinton's health, but so far the Trump campaign has not spoken publicly on Sunday's incident. We'll keep you abreast of the very latest, as always. This is VOA News. Muslim pilgrims from around the world are gathering near a hill just outside Mecca Sunday, where the Prophet Muhammad delivered his final sermon some 1,400 years ago. The day spent on Mount Arafat is the pinnacle of the five-day Hajj pilgrimage, which all able-bodied Muslims are required to perform at least once. Muslims spend the day there in deep prayer, many openly weeping as they repent and ask God for forgiveness. Syrian President Bashar al-Assad's government has accepted the ceasefire deal brokered by its Russian ally and the United States. Syrian opposition forces also said they welcomed the deal. However, since they feel neither Russian nor Syrian government forces adhered to earlier ceasefire plans, they are doubtful the ceasefire can hold. On the streets of Damascus, many reacted to the ceasefire agreement. Abdul Hadi al-Amari is a student. He believes this is the beginning of the end of the crisis in his country. He believes this truce is not like the previous one. He is demanding the opposition also separate itself from the Nusra Front and the Islamic State. Beyond the ceasefire, the primary aim of the United States, the United Nations, and non-governmental groups active in Syria is arranging broader access for humanitarian aid. Croatians are deciding on Sunday a new government and a snap election, marking the second time in a year a poll has been taken. Exit polls predict a close outcome between candidates of the Croatian Democratic Union and the left-leaning Social Democrats in their People's Coalition, possibly resulting in a new parliament that some say could be another barely functioning government. Initial results are expected late in the day Sunday. The news of the snap vote for the European Union's newest member came a day after the parliament was formally dissolved and less than a year after the last vote. Clashes between police and protesters erupted in southeastern Turkey Sunday after government announcement that it had replaced 28 elected municipal and district mayors in several predominantly Kurdish towns. The Turkish Interior Ministry said the removed officials are suspected of ties with what the government considers terrorist organizations. The U.S. Embassy in Ankara posted a statement on its website and Twitter that it supported Turkey's right to defend itself against terrorism, but emphasizes the importance of respect and due process and the right to peaceful protests. And Pakistan is rejecting a new attempt by Afghanistan to allow the landlocked country to engage in direct trade with India through its land routes, citing existing official arrangements between Islamabad and Kabul. I'm Michael Brown reporting in Washington. For details on much more news, join us at voanews.com.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington.
I could actually see the ashes. Looked like a snowstorm coming into the yard there. I didn't realize what it was. Nothing like that ever happened before in America. So it was a tremendous shock. It was a horror.
Sunday, September 11th is the 15th anniversary of the worst terrorist attack on American soil.
We are here as a Jubilee family to proclaim the meaning of our party. The party that we launch here today is an expression of our unity, our oneness, and our togetherness.
Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta launches a new political party ahead of next year's general election.
It teaches the B cells to produce more diverse and more effective humanized antibodies. And eventually, they can get to a neutralizing stage. So this is new.
And scientists move closer toward the development of an effective HIV vaccine. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Sunday, September 11th is the 15th anniversary of the worst terrorist attack on American soil in the nation's history. Today, many view the day those jets slammed into the World Trade Center in New York, the Pentagon near Washington, D.C., or crashed in a lonely Pennsylvania field mostly as an historical event seen from afar. For others, 9/11 remains a vivid memory that still brings personal pain. The viewer's Adam Phillips visited Times Square to ask passersby what September 11, 2001 meant to them on that day and has come to mean since.
It's just afternoon in Times Square at the height of the lunch hour, a busy time of day any time in the year. But it's also less than a week before the 9/11 anniversary, so Marvin Ariella pauses for a moment to remember that fateful day.
I was actually a little kid. I was in school.
What do you remember about that day?
Rushing home, my mom getting me from school, making sure I was safe and making sure I was home. And it was just so much going on. I was young, so I really didn't understand what was going on.
Even mature adults had difficulty understanding the extent of the horror as it was occurring. When the World Trade Center towers collapsed, they spread a cloud of gray ash made of debris mixed with human remains over many kilometers. Francis Donlin takes an extra deep drag on his Marlboro and recalls his 9/11.
Well, I was working at that time in Brooklyn for a bus company, and I happened to be in the yard where the buses were, and I could actually see the ashes. It looked like a snowstorm coming into the yard there. I didn't realize what it was. Nothing like that ever happened before in America, so it was a tremendous shock. It was a horror. Oh, yeah, something I don't like to think about. I mean, look at all the families that were destroyed, all the children that lost moms and dads. Whole lives were changed.
Did your life change?
My life didn't change. No, I can't say it did change. It made me a little more fearful.
Native New Yorker Gary Kaminsky has his own harrowing memories. He and his family had moved across the river to New Jersey, but he continued to work as a business executive in Midtown Manhattan. Within minutes of the second tower's collapse, Kaminsky and his colleagues were called into the boss's office and told to go home and await word.
My first thought was, well, how am I going to get out of the city and get home? But the one thing that really stood out in my mind was walking down 7th Avenue with hundreds of people right in the middle of the street, with no cars, no traffic. Storefronts were shut and the gates were down on most of them. It seemed like something out of a movie years in the future, where the city was barren and here we are walking down 7th Avenue. So it was a day that I'll never forget. The city has definitely become much more security conscious in the 15 years. Every morning there are National Guardsmen with rifles and police with assault weapons.
Canada-born Chaim Kind had never seen anything as dramatic as September 11th and its aftermath, except in the movies and in history books. He says the media coverage he saw on TV seemed unreal, surreal, and all too real all at once.
Almost like when I think about Armenia or the Holocaust in 1945, it just seemed like it wasn't really happening. It was horrific. It's actually a little entertaining too, not in a good sense, but then we move on. It's what we do with all catastrophe, and I don't think about it much. So now I'm going to spend the next few days actually thinking about what I actually feel about it. How do we feel? How are we progressing? What trauma are we facing? How has it affected our society?
Doug Portner, who operates a Times Square food truck, says September 11, 2001 continues to be a theme in his own life and in the lives of his city and the nation. He spent most of that day fretting about his father, a police officer.
It's actually my father's birthday, and he was a cop down there, so, you know, it's hard to contact him and everything. It was a difficult situation. It sticks with you, you know.
Was your father okay?
Oh, my dad was okay, yeah, but he knew a lot of cops and friends that were lost, so, you know, it just gets very emotional, you know. Now that it's the 15th anniversary, it's just like, wow, I can't believe it's been 15 years already. Like, where'd the time go? So, like, working up here in Times Square is, like, there's bomb threats all the time, and that's all, like, that's one of the things I think of, like, but, you know, the New York City cops, you know, they're there to help us. But, you know, things could happen, you know, in a split second. Like, you know, nobody expected what happened on 9/11 was to happen, but they said now, you know, people in schools, in, like, a U.S. history class, that's going to be like a new subject that they're going to talk about. Like, they're updating the books and everything. Like, U.S. history's changed a lot. So, you know, that's definitely something that's good to be talked about in school to get the knowledge out.
As the terrorist attacks of 2001 fade farther into the past, it'll fall to survivors, witnesses, policymakers, historians, and everyday people to try to understand what those events signified at the time and what they might come to mean over the decades and centuries. Curiosity and mourning are both very much alive at Ground Zero itself. The National September 11th Memorial and Museum has hosted nearly 7 million visitors from around the world since it opened in 2014. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
Turning to Africa, Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta has launched a new political party that he intends to use for a second and last term in office in the 2017 election. The launch of the Jubilee Party follows days of political haggling as other smaller parties disbanded to join the new party. For VOA, Mohammed Yusuf reports from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi.
Tens of thousands of people dressed in party colours thronged to Kasarani Stadium to witness the launch of the new Jubilee Party. 12 parties have dissolved and have united under the new party.
Mimi naitwa Janet Jerry, mukakai wa Limuru.
Kitu ambacho nilichovunia zaidi.
The ruling party and the current government took the opportunity to show its success and how people benefited under its rule. Addressing the jubilant crowd, President Uhuru Kenyatta said the new party affirms togetherness and peace.
We are here as the Jubilee family to proclaim the meaning of our party. The party that we launch here today is an expression of our unity, our oneness, and our togetherness. In launching it, we renew and we strengthen the ties that bind Kenyans together. We rise from the ashes of conflict to express the beauty of reconciliation and collective purpose.
In 1966, 3 years after Kenya gained independence, the biggest two political parties, the Kenya African National Union and Kenya African Democratic Union, merged, forging unity. The unity, political commentators say, followed years of ethnic nationalization. 25 years after that agreement, some politicians and activists took to the streets, demanding multi-party democracy, where people were free to join and form their party. In late 2007, political violence erupted in Kenya after incumbent President Mwai Kibaki won elections and was sworn into office. A power-sharing agreement in early 2008 ended the crisis. On Friday, Deputy President William Ruto told party delegates that multi-party democracy has contributed to intercommunal fighting in Kenya during elections. Ruto said he was confident the new party will bring some normalcy to the country.
We are laying a firm new foundation for the politics and the leadership and the management of public affairs of our country going forward. Because for much of the multi-party era, our practice of politics has given democracy a very bad name.
President Kenyatta and Ruto were accused of being behind the 2007 and 2008 violence and charged at the International Criminal Court at The Hague. In the ethnic fighting, more than 1,000 people were killed and at least 250,000 uprooted from their homes. Ruto said he and the president had a desire to bring different parties together and form one party with a national agenda. President Kenyatta said the new party will respect divergent views of its members.
We know that the unity of the past, the unity of our fathers and mothers, was lost because we succumbed to personality cults and because we did not protect internal democracy in our parties. Jubilee will not make the mistakes of the parties that came before us. Every shade of opinion will have its say in this party.
Hundreds of kilometers away from Nairobi, in the coastal city of Mombasa, the biggest opposition party, Orange Democratic Movement, was celebrating 10 years since its formation. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Many of us know about the ideals of democracy, at least the way it's ideally presented in school textbooks. But in practice, politics can be unpredictable and not always go smoothly. The Honorable Chinedu Ofor is a legislator in the Imo State House of Assembly in southeastern Nigeria. For several years, Ofor, who serves on the Imo constituency, was a reporter for The Voice of America. During a recent visit to Washington, VOA's William Eagle asked him about some of the biggest challenges he faces as a legislator.
It's a different mindset coming from, Washington, working in Washington, and also observing the way democracy is practiced in the United States. It's a little bit, while Nigeria practices the United States Constitution, the institutions, the infrastructure and things you need to get it done, as it should, it's lacking. It's a growing country. It's a growing state. You don't expect everything that the West takes for granted. For instance, power, meeting your constituency briefings and constituency briefings and constituency visits, it's a challenge. But the satisfaction is in that challenge, trying to do the very best that you can. Also, the demands of people. Over here in the United States, it's more policy-like and infrastructure. But down in Nigeria, there's still large-scale poverty. So people are more interested in food and other social issues than just policies and infrastructures. Especially if the resources are not available, meeting that challenge is a tough nut to crack.
When you say resources are not available, are you talking about money?
Exactly. Most political policies and political issues, if you want to bring them to life, you have to have a budget. You have to have money. There's a structural deficit. For instance, Imo State is mainly a civil servant state. What I mean by that is you have a lot of teachers, you have a lot of state government workers, and people depend on salaries and otherwise. And to that extent, previous administration, before the current governor, Okorocha, took over, did not put in place an industrial base. So Imo does not have like industries and firms that produce a lot of resources, unlike Lagos and Abuja. People over there, my people, depend mainly on their salaries. There's not a lot of companies and industries to employ people. The internal revenue generation of the state government is not what it should be. It does not make enough money through taxes to carry out its programs. So the state, like most Nigerian states, depend on allocation of resources and money from Abuja. Abuja depends on proceeds from oil sales to be able to service the economy and also give states their own allocation. So if there's a shortfall in money coming in from Abuja, the states can't do much, and they don't have the resources to implement their programs.
Many people say the answer is to diversify the economy. Is that possible, even though you lack funding?
Yes, it is. I'll briefly mention on the national level. President Muhammadu Buhari is trying to diversify and turn Nigeria from a mono economy, oil-based economy, into agriculture. There's been discussions about giving grants and also giving some kind of money to young people who would want to go into agriculture. There's a lot of emphasis now being placed in solid minerals because Nigeria is actually rich in coal, in gold, in silver. But in Imo State, the current governor, Olerosha Sokoraja, is doing a lot in terms of agriculture.
Chinodu Ofor is a legislator in Imo State, Nigeria. He spoke with viewers William Eagle from here in Washington, D.C. Representatives of 30 African countries have been working this week to map out ways to stop the continent's mass rural exodus at the Forum on Rural Development in Yaoundé. For VOA, Moki Edwin Kenzeka reports from the Cameroonian capital Yaoundé about why this matters to Africa's development.
Emmanuel Afesi works on his desktop at Oja Center in Cameroon's capital Yaoundé, where he is training 30 youths on information technologies at the center he created when he returned from the United States a year ago.
Africa needs to produce its own knowledge, its own equipment. That's why we want to train people within the continent. ICTs help close the gap between the developed and the developing world much faster than any technology, including motor vehicles. It's a large contributor to most African countries' GDPs today.
The 33-year-old Afesi says he was unemployed and fled to Paris and then the United States, where he was denied refugee status. He says he could not find work and decided to return home, sell his father's piece of land, and open the ICT center. Afesi was part of Africa's rapidly growing population of immigrants. The UN Refugee Agency report estimates this year nearly 47,000 migrants have reached Italy, the vast majority of them sub-Saharan Africans. A representative of Kenyan civil society organizations at the Forum on Rural Development, Vitalis Abasi, says many of the migrants are highly educated but unemployed and are traveling from rural areas in search of opportunities.
If the roads were good, the energy system was well, they could also access information communication technology. A lot of young people would stay in rural areas. We can lift people up in those areas by pulling agriculture production up. So once people get a bit more money in their pockets, it's now easier for the rest of the economy to grow.
Experts from 30 African countries adopted what they call the Yaoundé Declaration that invites Africa to invest more in the rural areas youths are deserting. They say Africa is losing its trained human capital if current trends continue. The head of program implementation at the New Partnership for Africa's Development, Esterine Fortabong, says governments should have the political will to create enabling environments with the private sector and civil society groups.
We still have the majority of Africans living in rural areas, despite the rapid urbanization rates. And from different studies, the projection is that up to 2035, that will still be the case. We still have most Africans employed in agriculture, and we still have lots of land in our rural areas. So why not invest in social amenities, in infrastructure, in better education systems, in industrialization in rural areas, so that youth will not see any reason to leave the rural areas to go to the cities?
The Yaoundé Declaration is accompanied by a call for action that requests African heads of state to support the implementation of an action plan being developed to stop Africans from having to make the dangerous trip to Europe. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
Scientists are one step closer toward the development of an effective HIV vaccine. The experimental vaccine is designed to retrain the body's immune system to direct a full-out assault against a complex foe, the virus that causes AIDS. VOA's Jessica Behrman reports.
Despite 30 years of intensive research, scientists have yet to come up with an HIV vaccine. That's because the AIDS virus rapidly mutates or changes its appearance, making it a moving target for vaccine developers. But in a tiny fraction of people infected with HIV, their bodies make what are known as broadly neutralizing antibodies. After a couple of years of infection, the immune systems of these individuals learn to recognize the viral mutations, cranking out antibodies that naturally block HIV in its many disguises. Scientists have tried to harness the potential of these broadly neutralizing antibodies and translate that knowledge into a vaccine that could induce antibodies in humans to fight against the ever-changing virus. After many years of work, researchers say they've taken a major step, though an early step, towards vaccine development. In a large-scale collaboration among researchers at a number of institutions, investigators have created an experimental vaccine that could coax the body into producing broadly neutralizing antibodies. Experiments with a vaccine, considered the holy grail among AIDS vaccine researchers, worked in a mouse model that mimicked the human immune system. The achievement was described simultaneously in 5 papers published in the journals Cell, Immunity, and Science.
And in several of the papers, this is shown that this approach works.
That's Frederick Ault, director of the program in cellular and molecular medicine at Boston Children's Hospital, who led research in creating the humanized mouse model. Ault says the approach, referred to as sequential vaccination, retrains the immune system's B cells to recognize and kill HIV by cranking out highly specific antibodies.
It teaches the B cells to produce more diverse and more effective humanized antibodies. And eventually, they can get to a neutralizing stage. So this is new.
Because HIV circulates in the human body in many variants that escape the immune system, scientists are trying to kickstart the production of antibodies that recognize the virus in all its forms. They did this with non-infectious genetically modified HIV proteins. These stimulate young immune system cells called precursor B cells to produce oddly shaped antibodies. The antibodies, which can recognize mutated versions of the AIDS virus, attach themselves to other components of the immune system that then seek out and destroy the virus. So far, scientists have engineered 2 proteins to prime the immune system. They were shown in the mouse model to produce antibodies that had many of the same genetic features as naturally produced broadly neutralizing antibodies. Because there are so many varieties of HIV, literally millions, vaccination would require a number of shots still to be developed that would be given to people in what researcher Bill Schief calls a stepwise fashion. Ideally, Schief says, no more than a few vaccinations would be required. Schief is a vaccine designer for IAVI, the International AIDS Vaccine Initiative, and among the many authors reporting their work.
Basically, what we're trying to do now is really make all that work, is devise vaccines that will teach the human immune system to produce broadly neutralizing antibodies so that after you get the vaccine, if you're ever exposed to the virus, you'll be protected no matter which of the tens of millions of strains that are circulating now you're exposed to. Hopefully it won't matter if we do our job perfectly well.
One of the stimulating immunogens, or proteins, will be tested in a clinical trial next year to see if it activates B cells the way it's intended. Schief stresses it's too early to tell for certain, but this work could rewrite the rules of vaccine development and vanquish a formidable foe, the AIDS virus. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
Next on Straight Talk Africa, an in-depth one-on-one conversation with Namibian president. The wide-ranging discussion will include the president's vision for the future of the Southern African nation. That's next, right here on Straight Talk Africa at 1830 UTC.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, sports with Douglas Mpuga and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Mpuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hello, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. Let's begin with the announcement by the Council for East and Central African Football Associations, SECAFA, that Kenya will host two regional tournaments. In November, Kenya will host East and Central Africa's regional championship, the SECAFA Senior Challenge Cup, instead of Sudan, who withdrew due to financial issues. A month later, the region's SECAFA Kagame Club Championship will also be held in Kenya instead of Tanzania. Tanzania were due to host the event in July and August, but pulled out because of a congested league program. The Tanzanian side, the Young Africans, also reached the group stage of the Confederation Cup and so would not have been able to take part in the regional tournament. Azam of Tanzania will defend the title that they won on home soil last year, while Uganda are the defending Senior Challenge Cup champions after winning in Ethiopia in 2015. In athletics, a four-time Olympic gold medalist, Mo Farah, became the first man to win the Great North Run three times in a row. Farah pulled away from American Dethan Risenhain in the last mile in his first race since retaining his 5,000 and 10,000 Olympic titles in Rio. In the women's race, Olympic 5,000-meter champion Vivian Cheruiyot of Kenya won in her first half marathon. The Great North Run is the world's biggest half marathon, and there were more than 41,000 runners taking part in this year's event from 178 nations. The 33-year-old Farah was taken on a fast pace by former American 5,000-meter record holder Risenhain, but powered away with a mile to go and even had time to do a cheeky heel flip before he crossed the line in 1 hour and 4 seconds, the slowest of his three wins. Belgium's Emmanuel Bet, who ran the second half of the race almost on his own, crossed in third. The women's race had middle-distance greats Cheruiyot and three-time Olympic champion Terunesha Dibaba. Dibaba failed to keep pace with Cheruiyot and fellow Kenyan Priska Jepto in the closing stages of the 13.1-mile course. It was Cheruiyot who took victory, producing a sprint finish to clock 1 hour 7.54, just 1 second ahead of Jepto. Ethiopian Terunesha Dibaba came in third. Meanwhile, on Friday, South Africa's Caster Semenya won her first international 400-meter race at the Diamond League meeting in Brussels. The 25-year-old, who won Olympic gold over 800 meters, beat a field featuring five Rio 2016 finalists, including bronze medalist Sherika Jackson. Semenya set a personal best of 50.40 seconds to win in Belgium. Adam Jemili also set a personal best in the 200 meters, but fellow Briton Elid Doyle was fifth in the 400-meter hurdles and missed out on the Diamond League title. Semenya won the 400 meters, 800 meters, and 1500 meters on the same day at the South African trials in April, but chose to focus on the 800 meters in Rio. Finally, in tennis, German's Angelique Kerber backed up her status as the new world number one with a thrilling win over Czech Karolina Pliskova in the US Open final. Kerber won 6-3, 4-6, 6-4 in New York to add the US Open to her victory at the Australian Open in January. Pliskova's semi-final win over Serena Williams had already ensured the German will top the new rankings on Monday. Kerber was appearing in her third Grand Slam final of 2016, and the German played with the authority of a world number one in waiting. The 24-year-old Kerber won in Australia and the US and finished runner-up at Wimbledon. She is the first German to win the US Open since Steffi Graf in 1996. She began 2016 ranked 10th in the world after failing to get past the third round of any of the Grand Slams in 2015, but Saturday saw her claim a tour-best 54th win of 2016. Later Sunday, defending champion Novak Djokovic will take on third seed Stan Wawrinka in the US Open final after both men won semifinals in punishing conditions. Djokovic beat 10th seed Jael Monfils 6-3, 6-2, 3-6, 6-2 in New York. Wawrinka beat Japan's 6th seed Kei Nishikori 4-6, 7-5, 6-4, 6-2. Djokovic will attempt to win his third US Open and 13th Grand Slam title on Sunday, while Wawrinka, who beat Djokovic in last year's French Open final, is going for a third major victory and first at the US Open. And that's it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent.
You are my master, I'm not alone. Anywhere you lead me, I will go. You are my master, I'm not alone. Anywhere you lead me, I will go. And I'll go, I will follow you. I'll go all of the days of my life, Lord. I'll go. Go. Safari, 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 zambali. Visa na mambo mengi.
vinateso najua ila mpenzi usijali na sumu ya mapenzi inatesa moyo mchana usiku silali sukari ya mapenzi ishaganda moyoni zaidi ya tamu ya sali tazama uzuri wako penzi langu sijashusha thamani thamani ya penzi lako nitalitunza moyoni na kesho peponi tazama uzuri wako penzi langu sijinishusha thamani thamani ya penzi lako nitalilinda moyoni na kesho peponi dunia na mapenzi vinateso najua sema mpenzi tafadhali usiku silali lalala uko tayari nikupeleke nyumbani japo sina pesa manyumba gani usijali nauliza uko tayari nikupeleke nyumbani japo sina pesa manyumba gani usijali ona yupo nilompenda kwa utenzi na nyimbo na zezi nilimwimbia akanacha akaenda na maradha kupenda moyoni nkaugulia yupo nilompenda kwa utenzi na nyimbo na zezi nilimwimbia akanacha akaenda na maradha kupenda moyoni nkaugulia maskini penzi langu sina pesa mari na gali za kuringishia chonde chonde roho yangu nasimanza mapenzi moyoni sijekulia maskini penzi langu sina pesa gali na mali za kuringishia chonde chonde roho yangu nasimanza mapenzi moyoni sijekulia dunia na mapenzi vinatesa najua sema mpenzi tafadhali maumivu ya mapenzi yanatesa moyo mchana usiku silali za uko tayari nikupeleke nyumbani japo sina pesa manyumba gani usijali nauliza uko tayari nikupeleke nyumbani japo sina pesa manyumba gani usijali
singa, tula soge, tula soge, tula singa, tata lomza.
That was our Sunday music spot. I hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of The Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Today marks the 15th anniversary of a horrific terrorist attack in the United States. A new expression emerged, 9/11. Specifically, on that day, 19 armed attackers breached airport security and boarded planes that attacked the World Trade Center Twin Towers, the Pentagon, and a hijacked plane crashed somewhere in Pennsylvania. The president at the time, George Bush, promised the American public and the world community that perpetrated that crime will be pursued, and all terrorist groups with a global reach will be brought to justice. His successor, Obama, was able to fulfill that promise when Bin Laden was killed in Pakistan. Since 9/11, the world has seen the explosion of terrorist activities throughout the world. It is true to say that Africa has borne the brunt of these terrorist acts. In the Horn of Africa, Al-Shabaab has caused havoc not only in Somalia, but in Kenya, in Uganda, and continue to do so many, many times in and around Mogadishu. In Nigeria, Boko Haram is also perpetrating serious terrorist crimes, and also in neighboring countries like Cameroon. What is distressing about these African terrorist groups is that they use young boys and girls to wear vests and explore themselves in marketplaces and bus stops. So terrorism in Africa has become a very serious security problem. But recently we have also seen the emergence of a new terrorist group. Initially it was Al-Qaeda with its affiliate like Al-Shabaab. But today ISIS is causing havoc throughout the world. We have witnessed the explosions in France, Belgium, and one could say also somewhere in Russia. So the international community, through the UN, has been battling the issue of international terrorism and trying to find ways and means to resolve the issue. And what we have learned since 9/11 is no matter how good and effective security forces are, there is always the possibility of the terrorists succeeding. So this is a lesson we should bear in mind. We have also known that it is not easy to abolish terrorism from the face of the earth. But this does not mean we should not continue our efforts. In the current campaign in the United States for the presidency, a major debating point is the nominee's strategies for counterterrorism, because the United States, even after 9/11, has also suffered terrorism within the confines of the country. But we also must bear in mind that without giving any reasons where you could make terrorism, there might be some underlying factors that may be stipulating or pushing terrorist acts. This is not to justify terrorism. No one can justify it. But the efforts must be made by the international community to see whether or not there are underlying factors that could be tackled together to prevent the further growth of international terrorism. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. And as you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sally, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Odette Frazier, and our engineer for today, the ever-friendly Michael Dubinsky, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, two men quarreling do not share the same seat on a canoe. I'm your host, Peter Clotte in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
15 years ago, September 11, 2001, nearly 3,000 men, women, and children from over 90 countries died when terrorists used hijacked civilian aircraft to destroy the World Trade Center in New York City and damage the Pentagon near Washington, D.C. They crashed another civilian airliner in a field in Pennsylvania when the passengers, realizing the hijackers' intent, refused to allow them to attack yet another target and fought back. The world changed that day, not because of the deaths of 3,000 people or because the attack took place in the United States, but because a group of terrorists saw fit to inflict as much damage as possible on random civilian targets. The people who died that day represent a cross-section of ages, ethnicities, and religious affiliations. They had nothing the terrorists wanted, had done nothing to cause harm to their murderers. They died because it is the nature of terrorists to attack those who are least likely and able to fight back, and in that way to cause revulsion and horror in all civilized people. That is why the United States, along with the rest of the global community, confronts terrorism everywhere and advances freedom and democracy as an alternative to the ideologies of hatred and repression. September 11th is a date seared into the minds of all of us at the U.S. Department of State and of citizens across America. Together, we honor the memory of the men, women, and children murdered in 2001, said Secretary of State John Kerry in a written statement. We also remember those who died in yet another 9/11 terrorist attack 4 years ago in Libya: Ambassador Chris Stevens, Sean Smith, Glenn Doherty, and Tyrone Woods. They were brave, dedicated professionals who worked on behalf of their country to help others live in freedom, dignity, and peace, wrote Secretary of State Kerry. Friends and adversaries alike should understand. The United States will never be intimidated by terrorists, he said. Terrorists can cause tremendous suffering, but they can neither weaken our determination nor sway us from our purpose. For Americans at home and overseas, shared tragedy brings us together, adds to our vigilance, and strengthens our resolve not only on September 11th, but every day of the year.
That was an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.